this dynamic is just really, I think, reflective of how the two parties view what they perceive as the reality, and sometimes the reality is not borne out in actual facts.
On this episode of the Politics Podcast, election law, voting access, and hopefully some fact-based reality. I'm Jeff Tabiri. In recent months, about 1,000 bills related to elections and voting have been filed at state capitals across the country. North Carolina has, not so surprisingly, largely stayed out of the headlines on this issue. A piece of legislation was filed last week in Raleigh, and we'll get to that in a bit. First, a national overview as we check in with a couple of other state capitals. Almost every state has seen some sort of election law proposal. Michael Bitzer teaches political science and history at Catawba College.
I think Democrats and Republicans are coming at this in two very different lights. And the way that they are approaching it is based on 2020's dynamics, but also looking towards the future. We're talking about issues of redistricting. We're talking about potential future competitive elections, certainly in the Senate as well. So this dynamic is just really, I think, reflective of how the two parties view what they perceive as the reality, and sometimes the reality is not borne out in actual facts.
My next question literally reads, is this truly an issue of integrity? How much of it is real? How much of it is perception, or is perception now reality? So that was my next question. You kind of already answered it.
Well, I think perception is certainly driving a lot of this, but perception may not be based in facts. And that is certainly the case when there are issues surrounding supporting such measures such as voter integrity. Yes, we have seen issues of election fraud. Yes, there are sporadic, minuscule incidents of voter fraud. But to say that we are pushing a lot of these measures, some of them fairly extreme in nature, based on the big lie, which is votes were taken away or voters showed up who weren't registered, it is just devoid of reality.
In terms of this being more, it's politics, so everything's about power, right?
It's politics, sure.
So much of it is, and I don't mean to just go, oh, it's just politics, but is this more about integrity or is it more about having control of power?
I think it's all based around the issue of power. I mean, this whenever I teach Intro to American Politics, my basic framework for looking at American politics is that it's a game, and it's a game about power. Who's got it? Who wants it? Who wants to keep it? And in particularly, the issue oftentimes revolves around what are the rules of the game of politics when it comes to getting power and keeping power. And I think that this just fits perfectly into that dynamic of it's all about power. How can we keep it? How can we punish the other side in the rules of the game?
More from Bitzer in a bit. The Brennan Center, a center-left organization, is tracking this deluge of legislation. As of late last month, according to the Brennan Center tracker, more than 250 bills included provisions that restrict voting access, while more than 700 proposals would expand a voter's ability to cast a ballot. Of course, the types of bills that have a chance are largely dependent upon the party in political power for a given state. So, let's hop around. First, to Georgia.
My name is Emma Hurt, and I am the politics reporter at WABE in Atlanta.
As you remember, the state flipped blue in November. Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by just 11,000 votes, though as you might also recall, we didn't know that on election night. And despite the fact that there has been no evidence of significant fraud in Georgia, the then-president did not patiently wait for the results or honor them when they arrived.
And so after that, we have this stream of fraud allegations, which were repeatedly, dispelled by Republican election officials that did not succeed in the courts. a similar story as we saw around the country. But still, all this had been said, all this frustration was there, and sure enough, 500,000 voters did not show up for the January runoffs that had voted in November. Most of them were Republicans, and Republicans lost the Senate runoffs. And so now there's a crisis of confidence among some Republican voters in the election system, which has translated into Republican state lawmakers who write the laws that are the voting code, trying to do something about it and trying to reinstate confidence in the system, even though this faltering confidence from Republican voters is largely rooted in false claims of voter fraud.
Republicans control both chambers of the state legislature and the governor's mansion in Georgia. What proposals have we seen in Georgia here in recent weeks, and what ultimately has been enacted?
So nothing has been enacted yet. We had about 80 voting bills, Democratic and Republican, that were introduced. But the proposals range far and wide from some of the, you know, what Democrats would call the scariest ones were proposals to eliminate no excuse absentee voting, to make, you know, only certain kinds of people with certain excuses could vote absentee. And a proposal to curb access to Sunday early voting, which is a big part of organizing in the Black community, particular souls to the polls type events. But those, you know, some of those, quote, scariest proposals have been watered down and pulled back. And so what we've really got on the table still is a photo ID requirement for all absentee ballots, which Republicans say makes sense because you have to have a photo ID if you're voting in person. So why not a photocopy or a driver's license number when you're voting absentee? Limits on drop boxes for absentee ballots. That's not something that exists in code. It was an emergency measure for COVID. And so now Republicans are saying, let's regulate this in a different way. Let's only allow them to be inside county election offices, for example. But that's still something, you know, Democrats have a problem with.
Politically, Georgia is one of the nation's most fascinating states. Two U.S. Senate races were also undecided on election night, ultimately resulting in January runoffs, which John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won in upset fashion, handing the Democrats the narrowest of Senate majorities for the next 2 years. The surprise results in Georgia led first to it being ground zero for claims of fraud, and now it's receiving an increased focus from political observers across the country. Next year, one of those Senate seats is up again, and Republican Governor Brian Kemp is up for re-election, likely to face Democrat Stacey Abrams. How election laws are written and implemented could have very real implications in a state where the margins are so thin.
I think, I don't know if it's as much of a test case as it is just a really dramatic example of like what's happened as former President Trump and others have continued to push these theories of voter fraud without evidence and the damage that's done to their voting base. And it has cornered Republican state lawmakers into feeling like they have to do something in order to get people's faith back in the system. And it's a self-inflicted problem for Republicans. And it comes in this very vulnerable time for them, baseline, when they are losing their edge of control in the state. Two Democrats won Senate seats. Joe Biden won the state. The Republicans still control the state capitol, but barely, it appears, you know, from far away, given those 2020 results. Mm-hmm. And so they are in a really tough spot because they need every voter. They need every voter to turn out. They don't need voters to be worried about whether their votes are going to count. And yet that's exactly what's happened. And so that's what they're trying to address, in really kind of pure political terms. That's what's happening.
So you mentioned watered down before, and I'm wondering why Republicans have, I'm now using the word softened, why have they changed or altered the trajectory on this? Is it because they realize they're potentially going to do more harm than good to themselves electorally? Or if you've got both chambers and if you've got the executive mansion and you're able to do whatever you want, why haven't they done something more to this point?
So there's a lot of things going on. First of all, historical context is that the current laws that, for example, allow no excuse absentee voting, that was passed by Republicans in Georgia. It has been a part of the Republican policy platform to have easy access to voting. Governor Brian Kemp was Secretary of State when automatic voter registration was enacted. And that's something that was on the table to roll back this year. And so I think, one, there's an awareness of this is a little bit hypocritical, guys. I know there are lobbyists who are trying to make that case to Republican state lawmakers. I think, two, like I said about the political climate here, Republicans are on thin ice. You know, they still control the legislature and the governor's mansion, as you said. So they could theoretically pass whatever they want if they all could stick together on a voting bill. But they saw the 2020 election cycle, and they know that if they do something that dramatic, that will not likely turn out well for them in a November 2022 race. I know that Governor Kemp is certainly thinking about that because he's likely to face Democratic candidate Stacey Abrams again. That's likely. She hasn't announced. And so he's very aware that he's got to try to win a November general election. And many of these statewide leaders are. But that's at odds with many of these state lawmakers who are in really conservative districts, who are hearing from their constituents all the time, who are worried about fraud and worried about the election system. And so it's really been a push and pull this whole time. This has been kind of a headless issue, I would say, because, you know, every Republican politician around here, it feels like, has something to say about voting, whether that's dropping their own bill or making a speech on the floor, or if you're the governor and you're saying, hey, let's maybe not do some of that very extreme stuff. Everyone has something to say on it because it's such a high-stakes issue. And there are competing priorities among the Republican caucus here. And it's, you know, a symptom of a state that's changing.
There haven't been any legal challenges yet because there's nothing to challenge legally, correct?
Correct. Nothing is in law just yet. But that is an important point to note that probably it's very likely that any of these bills that are passed into law will be challenged by Democrats and Democratic groups. They've already promised to do that. And so it's also very unlikely that any of them will be in effect in 2022. They'll very likely be held up in the courts. So that's the grand irony of it all, right? They're trying to fix the system, but what they do will likely not have any effect in their next election.
Emma Hurt, politics reporter for NPR member station WABE in Atlanta. Meanwhile, our neighbor to the north enacted a different kind of provision last week. Virginia's Democratic Governor Ralph Northam signed a bill into law that allows local election officials to accept absentee ballots dropped off in person on Sundays. State law in the Commonwealth only allows for early voting on Saturdays. Last fall, nearly 3 million Virginians, or about two-thirds of all people who cast a ballot, used the state's robust early voting period. It lasts 45 days. Let's head now to the Midwest and another state with a sizable early voting period.
You're seeing proposed voting restrictions in states that flipped for Democratic candidates in 2020, but in Iowa, we had record voter turnout and Republicans won pretty much everything.
Katerina Sestarek is state government reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Republicans control the legislature, governorship, and the state Supreme Court. Because of the pandemic, Iowa lawmakers actually decided to mail every registered voter a ballot in 2020. While there was no evidence of widespread fraud in the state, lawmakers put new regulations in place that would make it more difficult for that mail-to-all approach to transpire again. The changes are part of a recently approved bill that includes dozens of restrictive election provisions.
Some of the most notable provisions are shortening the early voting period from 29 days to 20 days before Election Day. And so that's also when absentee mail-in ballots will start getting sent out. And they also moved up the deadline for absentee ballots. So they really shrunk that mail voting period from both ends. They're also closing the polls on Election Day at 8 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. for general elections. And then there's a whole bunch of other changes to mail voting.
What has been the response? You talk about this bill that moved, that reduced early voting days, reduced the number of hours on Election Day. What has happened since the Republican governor has signed that into statute?
A lawsuit was filed the day after she signed it into law. It's from LULAC of Iowa, so a Latino civil rights organization, and they're backed by prominent Democratic voting rights attorneys like Mark Elias, and they're in their lawsuit, they're saying, you know, it's an unconstitutional burden on Iowans' voting rights, and they're calling it an exercise in voter suppression, and that still there hasn't been any movement on that, but that was filed immediately.
If a plan to reduce early voting resulting in a lawsuit sounds familiar, that's because it happened here in North Carolina a few years ago. Back in 2013, Republican lawmakers sent Republican Governor Pat McCrory a multi-pronged election bill. He signed it. Among its contents, the law eliminated same-day registration and out-of-precinct balloting, ended pre-registration for teens, and reduced early voting. In a ruling striking down the bill, a federal appellate judge offered a now infamous line stating that it targeted Black and Latino voters with almost surgical precision.
I think the voting restrictions that were passed by the North Carolina legislature were among the most extreme that I've seen in any state, both because of the timing and also because of the scope.
Ari Berman is senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of the book Give Us the Ballot.
They were extreme because of the timing, because they were passed by the legislature just a month after the Supreme Court had gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act. So you had Chief Justice John Roberts basically say that he didn't think that racial discrimination in voting was a huge threat in America. And then you had the North Carolina legislature turn around a month later and change so many portions of the state's voting laws to make it harder to vote in one form or another. And then the scope of the bill was so dramatic in that it seemed to target virtually everything in North Carolina that had made it a leader in voting, not just in the South, but nationwide. The fact that North Carolina had policies like early voting and like Election Day registration and like out-of-precinct voting. I mean, North Carolina was ahead of where much of the South and much of the country was when it came to expanding voting access, and that led to increased voting across the board, but particularly increased voting for younger voters, for Black voters. And so for them to try to roll back so much of that, I think that was among the most extreme efforts that we've seen in any states. And I think that's why when the federal court struck it down, they used such dramatic language in saying that this surgically targeted Black voters and saying that parts of what they did, like trying to eliminate Sunday voting, was as close to a smoking gun as you'll see in modern times.
In North Carolina, the history of voter suppression and the fight over ballot access is long. However, since that law was struck down in federal court a few years ago, election law has, for the most part, avoided being a point of controversy here. The issue partially went away after Republicans were thwarted by the courts, and more recently, it's due to our divided government and a Democratic governor who can presently sustain a veto. Still, Berman says the contents of the bills being proposed are instructive.
Well, even if things don't have a chance of passing, you want to see what's being introduced, because similar measures could pass in other states, or they could pass if things change politically. For example, if they get a veto-proof majority in the legislature.
Reminder, for the time being, Republicans do not have veto-proof or supermajorities at the North Carolina General Assembly. They did from 2013 until early 2019. Last week here in North Carolina, four Republican state senators filed the Election Integrity Act. Among other provisions, the legislation would prohibit collecting any absentee ballot after 5 p.m. on Election Day, regardless of when it was mailed. The bill would also reduce the amount of time a voter has to request an absentee ballot. Professor Bitzer, who you heard from earlier, calls this bill something of a test case. He wonders, will there be any Democratic support? If not, he believes it's likely to result in a veto and signal a stalemate on voting issues in Raleigh.
The way that I look at this legislation, it really is born out of 2020's battle. And I think in difference to what we saw in other states, particularly for the fact that Donald Trump won North Carolina in 2020, I think that this is more the battle between the legislature and the state board of elections over who has ultimate authority to write the rules of the game. So I think that this is more symbolic of the battle between Republicans in the legislature who were not happy with the Democratic-controlled state board of elections, basically revising under their emergency rulemaking powers, and they want to solidify what the dynamics are.
And they made, just to reiterate, they made some changes, the state board of elections, under the emergency powers avenue relatively late in the game. And that is what has left Republicans frustrated, at least some Republicans.
Yeah. And I think Republicans are critical in that regard to say you were changing the rules of the game in the middle of the game. And so I think certainly that is kind of the culmination of what we're seeing this battle over right now.
Historical cycles. Are there other examples in history when we have seen an abundance of these proposals born out of something that happened? Is this cyclical, or is this unique in American politics, this moment right now?
I think it's cyclical, but it tends to be not in a regular pattern. And, you know, I think in North Carolina, I would go back to the late 1890s, if I could, to talk about when one party gains control of state government, the other party gets fired up and energized and mobilized. And this happened in the mid-1890s with the fusionist coalition between Republicans and populists, and then the white supremacist Democrats backlash campaign. And what happened after Democrats won power was that they definitely changed the rules of the game to basically excise black voters from the electorate. I don't think that this is anywhere as extreme as those disenfranchising Jim Crow white segregationist attempts at legislating people out of the electorate. But we certainly see in a competitive nature, as this state has been, and the two parties that are so diametrically opposed to each other, there's going to be rules changed to benefit one over the other.
Short term, long term, what are the next steps that you're keeping an eye or an ear out for?
I think certainly short term is this new piece of legislation just the first volley in some future opportunities that the Republicans will propose for changes to the electorate? And then how do both sides, you know, whatever the outcome is, how do both sides react? Yes, there are always changes to election laws. Yes, one party will use some types of changes to their benefit or potentially punish the other side. But I think the big question in my mind is, will we see in future elections, particularly in this state, the intensity of turnout that we have seen both in 2018 and in 2020? Is this a new North Carolina electorate of very energized voters, or do things kind of rebalance back into a normalcy that we've seen beforehand? We just have to wait until those elections play out.
Michael Bitzer is a professor of political science and history at Catawba College. I've been doing this podcast for more than 5 years now, and I just wanted to say thanks. WNC, as you probably know, is a listener-supported entity. Quite honestly, the model of public media continues to amaze, if not at times baffle me. We're a decent-sized organization. More than 50 people work at the station. And each year, more than half of all the revenue WNC receives comes from listeners. They pledge $5 a month, $10 a month. I will share with you that I contribute $20 each month. Because despite the imperfections, and oh, believe you me, we have imperfections, I believe in what we're doing. And when I power on the recorder in this closet, surrounded by the meshware and sweatshirts, I'm appreciative pretty much every day for the work that I get to do, the work that I'm trying to do. This work is not possible without our listeners, without you. So a big, sincere thank you for listening and donating if you're able to give. I get it. Not everyone can do that. If you want to learn more about contributing, you can visit our website, wunc.org. And of course, when you're over there, make sure you check out the latest from Tested and Embodied, other podcasts that are not possible without you. Let's chat again on Friday for a review of some of the state's political news. Thanks for listening. I'm Jeff Tiberi.